treatment for schizophrenia and related psychotic disorders.
Great, thanks. So welcome everyone and thanks for coming today. The topic we'll be presenting on, as Elizabeth had said, is physical activity as an adjunct treatment for schizophrenia and related psychotic disorders, a systematic review. And the authors of this review include Brad Holowachek, Aaron Bidston, Andrea Mitchell, and Melissa Richmond and myself, Rachel Richards. This project was supervised by Dr. Darlene Rettenbach. So we'll begin today by introducing the topic of schizophrenia, describe the current literature concerning physical activity interventions within this population, and illustrate the need for and purpose of this review. Subsequently, we will describe the methods used to conduct the review, followed by our results, discussions, and concluding remarks. So let's begin by describing schizophrenia. It's a severe psychiatric illness and not altogether uncommon. A current systematic review found that the median incidence is 15.2 per 100,000, with greater rates in males than females. The onset of illness typically occurs during adolescence, and prominent features of this condition include cognitive, sensory perceptual, motor, and emotional disturbances in addition to reality distortion. Schizophrenia is marked by positive and negative symptoms. Positive symptoms include excesses such as delusions, hallucinations, thought disorganization, and catatonic posturing. Negative symptoms include behavioral losses such as affective flattening, loss of interest, demotivation, social withdrawal, psychomotor disturbances that include poverty of speech in addition to motor retardation. It's also not uncommon for persons with schizophrenia to suffer from anxiety or depression or both. And there's substantial variability in the presentation of clinical symptoms. In fact, 5 subtypes of schizophrenia have been described to reflect the varied symptom presentation, and these include paranoid, disorganized, catatonic, undifferentiated, and residual types. Treatment for schizophrenia is largely pharmacological, with primary medications being both typical and atypical antipsychotics. Both have demonstrated effectiveness in controlling symptoms and help stabilize the illness for many individuals. However, the medications are not without their side effects, and which can be quite debilitating and include sedation, weight gain and obesity, metabolic and cardiovascular disorders, in addition to motor disturbances. And approximately 5 to 25% of patients using antipsychotics respond poorly and require alternate treatments or adjunct treatments. And one very common adjunct in this area is cognitive therapy. The treatment described is therefore not without its complications, particularly with respect to comorbidity as well as relapse rates. Comorbidity is related to both the medication side effects, as I just described, in addition to lifestyle factors such as substance abuse, which is very prevalent, as well as smoking. And psychiatric relapse is another complication which can lead to recurrent hospitalizations. Factors associated with relapse of illness include such things as poor therapeutic response to medications, factors influencing non-adherence, such as the medication side effects, substance abuse, which can exacerbate symptoms, and stress both experience and activities of daily living, as well as traumatic events. The treatment complications related to comorbidity and relapses can therefore contribute to increased disability experienced by the patients with schizophrenia and resulting in decreased patient participation in society, as well as increased economical and social costs for families and the healthcare system. Consequently, there's a need to identify adjunct treatments to mitigate such complications. Exercise is one such adjunct. Studies concerning the influence of exercise have found that it reduces stress levels in non-clinical samples. Whereas among clinical samples, exercise can help to reduce symptoms of depression with an effect that's equivalent to cognitive therapy, and it also decreases relapse rates. Further, a meta-analytic study found that exercise helps to reduce symptoms of clinical anxiety. And studies including persons with schizophrenia have shown that exercise reduces medical comorbidity, such as helping to reduce weight loss and improving cardiovascular status. However, there is currently insufficient evidence concerning the effects of exercise on psychiatric and psychological outcomes in schizophrenia. For example, systematic reviews concerning exercise interventions within this population contain only physiological outcomes or few and methodologically weak studies using an exercise intervention. And one systematic review failed to directly assess the effects of exercise by embedding this intervention within a broader category of treatments such as distraction techniques. There does exist one protocol published in 2003 that aims to expand on the evidence. However, it includes only RCTs, which is a significant limitation since the majority of research to date on this topic is quasi-experimental. And to our knowledge, to this date, that protocol has not yet come to fruition in a review that has been published. So consequently, the overall impression derived from the literature is that there is a need to determine whether exercise can influence psychiatric and psychological outcomes in schizophrenia as demonstrated for other clinical populations, where evidence to support exercise as an adjunct treatment may produce more comprehensive therapy, better adherence to leading to a reduction in relapse rates, and importantly, increased therapeutic effectiveness. The purpose of this review was therefore to systematically assess the effects of physical activity and psychological and psychiatric outcomes in persons with schizophrenia and related psychotic disorders. The inclusion of persons with related psychotic disorders, specifically schizoaffective disorder, schizophreniform disorder, and bipolar disorder with psychotic features, was done to capture as much literature as possible on the topic, and is possible due to the close relation among disorders with often blurred diagnostic boundaries and fluctuating courses of illness and diagnoses among the patients with these conditions. This is also a very popular and common procedure within schizophrenia literature. Physical activity was stated as the intervention of interest here, since it is inclusive of exercise and is defined as bodily movement that is produced by the contraction of skeletal muscle and that substantially increases energy expenditure. The inclusion of all physical activity interventions again allows us to capture a broader range of studies, including all those with exercise treatments. And this review was conducted in accordance with the National Health Service Center for Reviews and Dissemination Report Number 4. Now on to the methods.
Next, we're going to explain the methods used to conduct our systematic review. We will speak to eligibility criteria, search strategy, study selection, quality assessment, data extraction, and data synthesis. Our eligibility criteria included the following subject characteristics. Persons with schizophrenia or related psychotic disorders, for example, schizoaffective, schizophreniform, and bipolar disorders with psychotic features. We included individuals with comorbidity as well as dual diagnoses, so for example, schizophrenia and diabetes. We placed no restrictions on demographic variables. However, subjects with concurrent brain pathology, such as stroke, subjects with major depression and psychoses were also excluded. In terms of intervention, we were looking for studies that included physical activity in isolation or concurrent with other interventions, such as cognitive behavioral therapy. There were no restrictions with respect to form of physical activity or setting. However, breathing exercises were excluded as they did not meet the operational definition of physical activity. Studies with regular maintenance treatments were included, such as pharmaceutical treatment. Studies were included if the outcomes measured were related to psychiatric and psychological parameters, including, for example, those concerning level of functioning and quality of life. Studies reporting only physical or physiological outcomes were also excluded. Also, outcome measures with no reliability or validity were also excluded. In order to be eligible for inclusion, study needs to be peer-reviewed, quantitative studies from 1960 to present day, including published and gray literature. French and English and foreign abstracts with sufficient data were also included. And we chose 1960 as the start date to ensure that studies reviewed we're in a time period when ethical standards for research, including human subjects, had been established and applied. We implemented a fourfold search strategy. We conducted an electronic database search, a hand search of relevant journals, a reference search of included studies and related systematic reviews, and contacted authors where full text articles were not available. Studies were selected by two reviewers who were each blinded to authors' names. Agreement and disagreements between the reviewers were recorded. Disagreements were mediated by a third reviewer. And upon analysis, inter-reader agreement was found to be excellent with a Kappa score of 0.93.
So we used two measures to assess methodological quality of the included studies. One measure was adapted by Bradshaw et al., who performed a systematic review that assessed healthy living interventions with persons with schizophrenia. And this measure includes forms for both experimental controlled as well as observational studies. It was adapted because it contains items that are salient to the population and intervention under study here. The adaptations that we made include adding an item to reflect ethical conduct, in addition to altering a scoring procedure for the item concerning attrition. This measure was not at all validated, except for having reliability measure within the previous study and the raters in that study. But it was for they did follow the CRD-4 report in developing that measure, and we thought it was very practical for use here. Another quality assessment measure was developed by Shaddad. This measure was assessed as blinding randomization and attrition, and it's a well-recognized tool. It was included to allow for a better understanding of how the body of literature in this review compares to others in the field and across disciplines. All measures were pilot tested by three reviewers on literature concerning exercise and depression. However, quality assessment of included studies was conducted by just two independent reviewers, and agreement level was recorded, and a third reviewer was available to mediate any disputes.
In terms of data extraction, two reviewers created and pilot tested data extraction forms on related literature. The data from the included studies were extracted independently, then compared, and then compiled. A priori, we planned a descriptive synthesis of the data due to the expected heterogeneity of the included studies. However, we considered the possibility of performing a meta-analysis on a subset of studies. And now Melissa will give us a description of the studies included in the review.
Okay, I will now outline the features of the included studies with regards to subjects, study design, interventions, outcome measures, and other features. The literature search identified 275 abstracts consistent with the eligibility criteria. From that, 67 full-text articles were pulled. 59 of these were available in English or French, while 5 were in foreign languages and 3 were unavailable in print. So of those 59, 15 met our eligibility criteria. A total of 400 participants were part of the included studies, made up of 209 males, 113 females, and 78 which were left unknown. The mean age of the subjects was 35.7 years, but two of the studies did not provide age data. 9 of the 15 studies used standardized diagnostic criteria, such as the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is a tool set out by the American Psychiatric Association. 9 of the studies were completed in the USA, and one in each of Canada, Scotland, Israel, India, and Spain. So of the included studies, 4 were randomized controlled trials, 9 were quasi-experimental designs, there was 1 case series and 1 case study. 4 studies were completed in an inpatient hospital setting, 8 in an outpatient setting, 1 in the community, and 1 occurred in a mixed inpatient-outpatient setting. The duration of the interventions of the studies ranged from 4 weeks to 10 years, with follow-up phases as long as 2 years. So the included studies implemented a wide range of interventions. Of the 4 randomized control trials, 1 compared treadmill walking to a group doing no exercise. A second had a physical exercise group that completed walking and large body movements, as well as a relaxation group. A third group looked at yoga therapy as its intervention and compared it to a physical exercise group who did brisk walking or jogging. And a fourth randomized control trial had a holistic treatment group who completed a walk run along with stress education and meditation, and as well as a social skills treatment group who did some role playing. In terms of our quasi-experimental studies, one compared a walking group to a group undergoing treatment as usual. One implemented its intervention as recreational games and skills. One used fitness training, which featured cardiovascular machines and strength training. 2 called their intervention aerobic exercise, but it was essentially an aerobics class that the participants completed. 1 study's intervention was outdoor adventures, which included climbing and canoeing. And 1 study compared a running group to 3 control groups. 1 of their control groups was a group that was waiting to run. 1 was a group completing random activities, such as poetry and cooking classes. 1 group was doing a meditation, and 1 was a group that was going to do a new meditation group to control for the novelty effect of performing a new activity. And another study compared active and passive therapeutic recreation, and active therapeutic recreation was doing something like playing a volleyball game, whereas passive was playing cards. And finally, a final study had an exercise intervention, and in that case, it was playing a soccer game and doing balance and agility tasks. And they compared it to a standard care group. We had a case series in which subjects did aerobic exercise on a stationary bike, and a case study in which the subject did weight training. Okay, so we had 36 different outcome measures identified in our studies. There were psychiatric outcome measures, for example, anxiety and depression measures, and psychological outcomes, including behavioral and self-efficacy scales. And we divided these 36 outcome measures into 12 categories based on their criteria assessed. We also collected data on attrition, adverse events, completion of a health screen for activity intervention, and compensation for participation. However, due to time constraints, we're not going to speak to these points in this presentation.
Okay. We'd like to now take, with respect to the results concerning methodological quality, the scores on the Bradshaw measure were transformed into percentages, where the mean was 56% with a range of 35 to 82. 4 studies scored below 50%, 9 studies scored between 50 and 75%, and 2 studies scored above 75%. Items with low scores on this measure include such things as lack of diagnostic criteria or failure to randomize or failure to even do a power calculation or intention to treat analysis where applicable. And this is going to be discussed a bit more in detail under the context of our recommendations in the discussion section. There was substantial inter-rater agreement on this measure. With respect to the JADAD, possible scores range from 0 to 5. However, in this sample, we only saw a range of 0 to 2 with a mean of 0.8. And the reasons for this poor outcome are things such as lack of double blinding or random assignment. In addition, dropouts and attrition were underreported. And as with the Bradshaw, there was substantial inter-rater agreement on this measure.
Okay, so we assigned a level of evidence for the studies according to the Cochrane musculoskeletal group method of grading, and it warrants the grading of silver because the body of literature featured small sample sizes, limited blinding of assessors, and no blinding of subjects to the intervention. Okay, we will now outline the results of our systematic review, some limitations encountered, and then Brad will make some recommendations for future research. So I mentioned earlier that we had 12 categories of outcome measures, and they're all listed on the screen. But due to time constraints, I'll only be speaking to the 5 highlighted points, which featured the most significant results. However, the included studies reported data on all of the categories listed here. So 7 studies reported on anxiety and depression. 2 randomized control trials studied the effects of exercise and on anxiety in persons with schizophrenia. The holistic health versus social skills training study found no significant differences between groups. The study examining physical activity and relaxation also found no between-group differences, but significant within-group reductions on anxiety measures were found. 4 quasi-experimental studies looked at both anxiety and depression measures. In one study, the adventure group had significant decreases in anxiety and depression compared with controls. Similarly, in another study, a running group had significant decreases in anxiety and depression compared with their controls. Further, 2 additional studies using anaerobic exercise interventions reported improvements, but not significant between group differences. And finally, in a case series, found a general trend of a reduction in depression.
Okay, so in summary, most of the studies that examined anxiety and depression as an outcome measure demonstrated a decrease in these symptoms. Because this was the measure most often examined, and that the one that demonstrated the most statistically significant results, the group chose to investigate the subject further. We found that a great number of studies demonstrate the ability of physical activity to decrease symptoms of anxiety and depression in a healthy population. So our question then becomes whether it's possible to view the symptom decreases noted in the studies reviewed as part of the schizophrenic spectrum or perhaps due to a coexisting condition. If this is the case, then for future research to better understand the role of physical activity in the treatment of schizophrenia, the researchers may want to focus on outcomes more specifically related to the schizophrenic spectrum.
Another outcome measure that we looked at was global symptom severity, and 8 studies looked at this parameter. 1 RCT compared a holistic health intervention, including exercise, to a social skills training program and found no significant between-group differences. However, significant within-group measures showed an improvement in overall psychiatric status for both groups. In terms of quasi-experimental studies, 1 study found significant differences between the control and aerobic exercise group with the aerobic exercise group improving in somatization and hostility. Similarly, another quasi-experimental study found significant between-group differences with the treatment group of outdoor adventure activities and interpersonal sensitivity and hostility scores. Further, although another study did not report between-group differences, significant within-group reductions in obsession, compulsion, and phobic anxiety were reported for an aerobic exercise program. However, 3 quasi-experimental studies reported no significant differences. Finally, 1 case series did identify a general trend of increasing improvements over time with structured exercise.
So to summarize global symptom severity outcomes, although between-group differences were found by only 2 studies, the significant within-group changes reported may suggest clinical relevance for these studies in terms of decreasing global symptom severity.
Relapse rate was looked at by 2 studies. A randomized control trial found no significant differences between a holistic health and a social skills intervention, while 1 quasi-experimental study found significantly fewer relapses in the exercise group compared to the control group.
So relapse rate was only examined by 2 studies. However, given the economic and social impact that schizophrenia relapse can have on clients, on families, and on the healthcare system as a whole, the group believes this is an extremely important measure that should be addressed more often in future research.
In terms of quality of life and functioning, one study compared yoga therapy to physical exercise training and found that yoga therapy had significant improvements in quality of life and functioning as compared to the physical training group. However, both groups showed within-group improvements on the functional measure. A second study found no change in quality of life scores as a result of exercise and diet interventions.
So to summarize, yoga as an intervention was found to have the greatest effect on quality of life and functioning, and indeed a greater effect than physical activity itself. A further investigation of this effect leads us to propose that perhaps the self-reflective nature of yoga itself may play a role in its ability to affect such subjective measures as quality of life and functioning.
Okay, 7 studies looked at the effect of physical activity on symptoms of schizophrenia. One randomized controlled trial found what they called clinically significant reduction in symptoms in a walking group. Another randomized controlled trial found significant reductions in symptoms for a yoga group as compared with a physical training group, and significant within-group reductions in both groups. Another RCT demonstrated significant within-group reductions for both a holistic health and a social skills group. With our quasi-experimental studies, 3 reported no differences in symptoms, while one case study actually found increases in symptoms as a result of weight training. However, the author explained that this was likely due to the fact that while he experienced a decrease in his negative symptoms, other subscales increased on the tool they were using, resulting in an overall increased score.
So to summarize that, it's evident that the results of the measures for symptoms of schizophrenia are mixed. Some studies demonstrate between-group changes, while others only demonstrate within-group changes, and others show no change at all. Taken together, these varied results may indicate clinical significance for the ability of physical activity to affect symptoms of schizophrenia. The group feels that in order for researchers to better capture changes in symptoms, analysis should be performed on the subtypes of schizophrenia. Many subtypes of schizophrenia are identified, as discussed by Rachel in the introduction, and these symptoms can display various symptom presentations, these subtypes. Therefore, by performing analyses on particular subtypes, sensitivity to change may be increased and physical activity may be more appropriately tailored to a particular subtype. Other outcome categories not addressed as often include self-efficacy and concept, self-image, locus of control, pain, psychomotor, behavioral, as well as trust and cooperation. Despite the current lack of research focusing on these outcomes, the group feels that these measures are relevant to a holistic treatment approach and should therefore be considered by future research in the area. So next, we're going to just speak briefly to limitations encountered by the review. The first limitation encountered was due to the relatively small breadth of literature available on our review topic. As was discussed in the introduction, the majority of research in this area examines physical activity with respect to physical and physiological outcomes, such as weight loss or cardiovascular fitness. A much smaller number of studies were found that examined psychological or psychiatric outcomes, as were the subject of this review. Heterogeneity was a major limitation of the included studies, which ultimately hindered our ability to perform a meta-analysis on the data. 3 main categories of heterogeneity were study design, population characteristics, and intervention type. In terms of study design, all studies were included which fit the quantitative inclusion criteria. Therefore, included studies range from case study to randomized control trials, with the majority of studies being quasi-experimental in design. Population characteristics also differed amongst the included studies and consisted of differences in research setting, presenting diagnosis, sample size, and medications. Interventions were also heterogeneic in so much as their design and amount of supervision. The presence and length of follow-up also varied among the included studies. The methodological quality of included studies was generally poor, and this further contributed to the limitations of the review. Given their relevance to further future research, issues surrounding methodological quality will be discussed later in this presentation under the context of recommendations. The inclusion criteria for this review, which, as discussed by Aaron, consisted of restrictions based on study type, language of publication, and physical activity intervention used, further led to bias of the literature by narrowing the scope of studies which could be included in this review. In an attempt to mitigate all types of bias, this review was conducted according to standardized guidelines as laid out by the CRD Report 4, as well as by choosing to include non-published literature in the review.
So we're now going to touch on the recommendations, which are based on the methodological issues mentioned in the limitations section. And as we mentioned previously, we're only going to touch on the areas we felt required the most attention. And these include diagnostic criteria, sample size, physical activity criteria, follow-up, and other issues. The first issue I'm going to discuss is a matter of standardized diagnostic criteria. Many studies did not use standardized diagnostic criteria, and those who did often failed to classify subjects with regards to their respective diagnostic subtypes. The group feels that this lack of standardization weakens the credibility of any given study, because without a standardized diagnosis, a causal relationship between the intervention and true schizophrenic symptoms cannot be made. Therefore, our recommendation is that all studies use standardized diagnostic criteria, such as the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM, and include subtype diagnoses to account for the various symptom presentation of these subtypes. This will assist future research in more clearly identifying the relationship between physical activity and the various symptoms of schizophrenia. Sample sizes of the included studies were consistently small, and no studies used power calculations to determine the appropriate sample size required to detect change. Our recommendation is for studies to perform power calculations when appropriate to do so, and to also increase sample size to the level needed to detect change. And with regards to physical activity criteria, few studies use interventions that were designed and/or supervised by qualified personnel. Our recommendation is for studies to simply follow standardized criteria such as ACSM, and also to ensure that the study is supervised accordingly so that the intervention is performed in an appropriate fashion. Using standardized criteria may also help to create more homogeneous interventions and allows for comparisons between studies. Appropriate supervision provides increased credibility to the results because both the researcher and the reader can be assured that the intervention was performed as it was designed. The last issue we're going to touch on here is follow-up, because very few studies demonstrated an appropriate follow-up. For the purpose of this review, in the qualitative assessment that we use, follow-up was defined as occurring no sooner than 1 month post-intervention and no later than 3 months. We chose this time frame based on the fact that physiological effects that are gained from physical activity fade over time if they're not maintained. And we made the assumption that psychological effects could potentially fade in a similar fashion. It's our recommendation then that future studies select and use an appropriate follow-up time frame for which that is specific to the intervention being used. There are five other issues that are of methodological relevance that I'll briefly mention, which include subject selection, baseline comparison, medication standardization, attrition, and adverse effects and/or events. Our recommendations are that studies employ random subject selection when possible, that baseline comparisons be performed in order to detect between subject variability, that chlorpromazine equivalents be used, and these transform all medications into a single standardized unit that allows the authors to treat medications as a covariate, and this allows them to therefore parcel out the effect of medication when assessing the physical activity intervention. We also recommend that attrition be correctly reported and that any and all adverse events be correctly identified. So in summary, we recommend that authors use a standardized diagnostic criteria, that there be adequate sample sizes, that authors use standardized physical activity interventions, that there be appropriate design and supervision for physical activity interventions, that authors perform subtype analyses by diagnostic category, that there be an appropriate follow-up, and that authors consider sampling methods, baseline data collection, medication standardization, and report attrition and adverse events. So, in conclusion, the results of this review are not sufficient to indicate that physical activity can produce a significant change in the results related to psychological and psychiatric outcomes. There is, however, suggested clinical relevance for many of the findings. Given that physical activity is beneficial to overall health and mental well-being in a healthy population, it may be that physical activity can still be considered a useful adjunct for persons with schizophrenia and related psychotic disorders. By using improved methodological qualities, such as those outlined in the summary, future research may result in a higher level of evidence and may also clearly more demonstrate the role of physical activity as an adjunct treatment. This review also provides a compendium upon which further research can be based because so many outcomes have been identified on which further research is needed.
Okay, we'd like to take this opportunity to thank everyone who's helped us throughout this project. Special thanks to our supervisor, Dr. Darlene Redenbach, for her enthusiasm, guidance, and support. To Dr. Angela Bush for her instruction and generous feedback on our proposal and methods. to librarian Charlotte Beck for her consultation and assistance to develop an efficient search strategy, to Melissa Knarvis, Kathy Fuller, Dr. Kathy Jorgensen, and Dr. Stephen Levin for permission to include the findings from their unpublished dissertations in this review, and finally to physiotherapist Inga Cruiser and recreational therapist Donna Beniusis of Riverview Hospital in Coquitlam, BC, who provided a clinical visit for us and perspective concerning practical applications of physical activity interventions in the psychiatric setting. We have several references in this presentation. Thank you very much for your time, and we'll open the floor to questions.
Sorry, it might be my lack of understanding, but can you maybe describe how you would define a relapse, or how you would get to, do you get to a state of remission per se?
Yeah, because the medications can really often stabilize people so that their symptoms are totally under control. And so they can go through periods where they can function normally. A relapse is when the symptoms start to escalate despite the fact that their medication dosage hasn't actually changed. So it might mean that they're not responding as well to their medication anymore, or that something in their environment has perpetuated the relapse for them. And there's just several factors that affect relapse. We couldn't possibly comment on all of them. But does that answer?
So were most of the participants in the studies then, were they under control with medication, or did you have symptomatic participants?
The problem is that 10 studies reported that people were taking medication out of 15 studies, okay? And from that, no one reported whether or not their patients were controlled or not, or how they were responding to the medications. There was, I think, three, where patients had exacerbations and withdrew, either before the study began, like during the exercise testing, the health screen that they put them through to participate, they had an exacerbation of symptoms and just withdrew, or during the course of the study, they withdrew. So it wasn't something that was it wasn't really commented on how stable these patients were at all, in any way, except for the adverse events. And
so yeah, you bring up a really good point, and that would be something that studies should report as well.
So just one more question though, if they are controlled, how do you tell, if they're being controlled by medication that's consistent in both the control group and the intervention group, how do you tell that exercise is making a difference on the symptoms if the symptoms are under control?
And that's where we talk about chloroquinoline equivalence, where I don't know if it was confusing at all, but what a chloroquinoline equivalent can do is it basically standardizes all the medications that a patient is taking into a single, is it like a dosage? So essentially what happens is then the authors can, or the study can control for that, and then they can more clearly identify the relationship between the physical activity intervention and the actual the whatever scales they're using, the outcome measure that they're using. And so it's not perfect, but it's the best way that they can to control for that.
Yeah. It's a common method used in psychiatrists use chlorpromazine equivalents. Chlorpromazine is an antipsychotic, so it's basically transforming all other antipsychotics into a chlorpromazine dosage, and so everyone's on a common medication, right? And then you can, at the start of the study, go, what are the baseline differences between groups on that measure? If they're, you're assessing subject variability, or you can, if your design allows for it, it's a covariate, so it's something that the statistical model will pull out, and then you can really try to identify the treatment effect. I mean, because medication is a confound, right? Like, it's an extraneous variable.
I guess it just, I don't really know much about schizophrenia, but I guess my question is more like, they're on medications, are they still having some symptoms of schizophrenia?
I think it's important
I was under the impression like if it was under control, they weren't having symptoms, so how could you tell if there's something?
They're managed, the symptoms. They still may have they still will have symptoms, but they're under control, they're not out of control, would be the thing. So they can still monitor the changes.
Okay.
And that's like actually one of the huge things with relapse is that patients are on their antipsychotics and they're feeling really good. And then they're like, I'm feeling good. So they take themselves off their meds and then they plummet. So.
Just wondering if any of the studies that were included in your review did do the medication equivalents and if that affected the strength of their findings at all?
Absolutely. Actually, two studies actually included quorum equivalents. And actually, those two studies were among the highest actually that were rated on the Bradshaw Quality Assessment Score. They also did quite a few other things. They did a diagnostic. They actually included like a diagnostic, the DSM. Their studies were well designed beyond that as well. So that actually really contributed to the results and the quality.
And in terms of the results of their findings, like, did they have different findings?
Sorry, can you? Yeah, I know what you're saying. The one study by Duraswamy, the yoga study versus physical training, they assessed baseline differences. They used it as a covariate, and there was, because they used it as a covariate, they were controlling for it throughout the period. So, I mean, that's a measure of control. So they found the treatment effects that we described. The other study was a study by Lukoff, and that was the holistic versus social skills training. And they assessed baseline differences and found no differences between groups. So.
I was just wondering if you found a trend in dosage of exercise that was ideal for controlling symptoms or duration of time?
We found the interventions were all over the map, mm-hmm. and we tried to indicate that with the one slide. For example, some were doing aerobic exercise training on a treadmill, and others were doing outdoor activities for a day long once a week. So because it was all over the map, it was hard to pick out whether or not one thing was better in particular in comparison to others.
And the intervention, and the intervention length actually really ranged too. Like we had some from 3 weeks up to 10 years. So it was really heterogeneous.
So was the exercise like,
no one assessed it after just one time, so that's kind of what you're asking, but we just found that there was just such variation, so it was hard to determine.
Did any of the studies report any adherence to the exercise programs or any issues with that?
I mean, I guess it would have been parceled under attrition.
And also maybe.
So they did, but the thing is, often if they didn't adhere, they would be considered dropouts, and so they wouldn't include them in their final results.
That's right.
So adherence was a big challenge, I think, in a lot of the studies, and so they would only report, they would say, well, they dropped out, so they weren't included. So it was really hard to tell, because they would call their sample a 15, say, and 15 at the end, even though there was probably an additional 8. That started but didn't continue, so they didn't include them. And that happened in quite a few of the studies.
Yeah,
so if a subject didn't attend one of the sessions, they would be...
Yeah, or maybe like they had different rules. It was one or two, so if they stopped attending, basically.
And one study, passive versus active therapeutic recreation, they actually recorded the number of times subjects attended. And so it was all over the map. So what they did was they did an analysis prior to doing all their statistics to make sure that adherence wasn't going to influence their data, because they wanted to include everyone. And so they did a model, and there was no effect of adherence. And so they went on to include everyone in their data, in their analysis. So.
I had another question. You excluded subjects who had major depression, and I was just wondering the rationale for that.
I think most of it comes from the schizophrenia literature, because it's really common, like in cognitive studies in schizophrenia, to include patients who are similar in spectrum of diagnosis. And depression, although people with depression can experience psychosis, it's not nearly as common as with like a bipolar disorder or disorder with psychotic features, where the psychotic features can persist for a very long period of time, or schizoaffective disorder is an affective disorder where there are psychotic features throughout. They remain even when moods fluctuate, and they can't be explained by mood states. And so I guess it was just, you know, there's already compounds in introducing like diagnostic categories, but it's something that's done commonly, like by melding diagnostic categories. But depression is such its own thing that, you know, and the psychoses in depression isn't nearly as common.
I think it was another question.
Yeah, I don't know much about mental disorders, but I would think that like hearing voices a lot in yoga, just my first thought was that if you practice yoga, maybe you're real. It's not funny. If you're practicing yoga and you focus on that voice all the time, did they mention anything about that?
There's no mention.
But it's a good point.
Yeah, we didn't consider that.
I had a question regarding pain. I believe you guys said that you would look at it further. Can you talk to like the nature of the pain? Like, is it a chronic type of pain or a muscle
spasm? The thing is that one study that reported on pain mentioned that they were collecting data on pain using the visual analog scale, and then they didn't report any data. They didn't report the statistics, sorry. So we couldn't really interpret it, and that was the thing. So they didn't say what kind of pain.
To look at pain more or to not look at pain?
Pain was included as to one of the outcomes that we thought is an important measure for a holistic treatment. So yes, it needs to be looked at more, and it needs to be reported by more studies.
And so what type of pain do schizophrenics normally experience? Is it quantifiable, like as musculoskeletal or neurogenic?
Some patients have what's called somatization, and it's like a pain that has no really organic substrate, and it almost coincides sometimes with delusions. Like, you know, their arm is, like they have this pain in their arm, and it could be because an alien implanted itself in their arm, and I don't know. You know, I mean, it's just,
so it's definitely prevalent.
It's a psychiatric thing. And the authors in that paper poorly described it, and they said that their visual analog scale was on pain, but it said their verbal quantifiers were something like, you know, are you feeling well versus not feeling very well, and that to me isn't pain. Like, are you in pain or are you not? Versus, are you feeling well or are you feeling unwell? I mean, that's sort of like a sense of well-being. It's different from pain, so.
I have a question that sort of followed up on the guidelines for mental health for exercise. And I think typically when we think of the ACSM guidelines, we think of the cardiovascular benefits. And yet we do know that there are parameters for bone health, there are parameters for musculoskeletal conditions and cartilage, and as well as, you know, heart and lung. And we do know that the cardiovascular, when you train accordingly, that it does have mental health benefits, but are there some other, as I think was identified, other parameters that you came across, and I don't think actually that, or any suggestion about how those might be modified for optimizing mental health benefit in this type of population? Was that reflected on at all in any of your?
We didn't find any guidelines that spoke directly to mental health populations, but I think it's an individualized prescription has been a theme in many of the systematic reviews, I think would be key, because these people may have other cardiovascular conditions like diabetes, and so we also have to prescribe according to what else they have. And so the benefits for mental health are, but we can't make a cookie cutter mental health prescription, I don't think.
I think even and even within the spectrum of schizophrenia itself, we spoke a lot to the need for subtype analysis and that maybe increasing the ability to tailor an exercise program. And so within that is, again, it goes back to not only individualize in terms of comorbidities that a patient may have, but also the type of schizophrenia and symptoms that person might have. So really,
exactly.
I think, you know, the broad message is individualizing. So
that also relates to the social component. And, you know, some of the exercise programs look very individual, and others, and as soon as you change that context, And two things can happen. We know generally that we just feel better when we're with other people, irrespective of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is you have a condition here that has potential for paranoia overlay, yeah. And that could be the very worst thing.
Exactly.
Was that discussed? I mean, it could have actually contributed to the full benefit that was seen, just if you don't control for that social component, or it could have an adverse effect.
Yeah. We only found one study that actually had individualized intervention. The others were all group treatment, and I believe that most of them benefited in the group treatment.
Even the treadmill walking one, they brought in treadmills, and it was a group treadmill walking. So again, like it could, depending on the patient, that could have been the best thing for them or the worst thing. So
and you can't exactly talk to each other, you know, when you're on treadmills.
And no one spoke to paranoia or anything like that, except for how we said that two studies did comment on the symptom exacerbations during exercise testing. I think it was two.
And in one of the studies, did I hear one of you say it referred to exercise and diet? And was, in fact, diet sort of controlled in any way? Because, you know, who knows? We just don't know what the impact of diet would be. And sometimes people in their desperation or their families say, you know, you should only be eating this kind of food. Or was that addressed? Standardized?
There's a Weight Watchers program that sort of
happened. Mm-hmm. It's probably, though, a very balanced diet as opposed to something that tends to be, you know, lots of this. And my very last question is, you began talking about some cross-cultural studies, and I'm always interested, being a bit of a cross-culturalist, about what are the prevalence of these conditions, you know, to kind of get at the nature-nurture or environmental question a little bit. And I know, of course, we all have difficulty collecting data, and in low-income countries in particular, getting credible data. But just wondering if you had a sense of how Western countries compare with others, or high-income countries compare with middle and low.
I'm not certain. I almost feel from past readings that Western countries have higher prevalence rates. However, that systematic review on the incidence, where the median was reported 15.2 out of 100,000, That median was a range between like 2 to 70 per 100,000, where the median was 15.2. And that was a systematic review concerning incidence as related to various factors. And it did explore culture. And I know that it included a number of studies that cross-culturally. So I think that would be maybe an appropriate estimate.
Actually, there was one last question. And that is regarding the quality of life. You know, often, and does it come down to your own reality, basically? Mm-hmm. When we're dealing with people who have what we normatively might sort of say is a distortion of reality, how do you factor in their self-report of how they're doing versus by proxy what their families, how their families believe they're functioning? Do you believe we go with the individual? Do you go think the family has the... you know, the stranglehold on the reality of quality of life for that person?
I think that it's difficult to, it's certainly, you know, a point to say that is the person capable of making a subjective opinion about how they're doing, but I think it would be inappropriate to take out that perspective altogether, and so maybe the best method would be to rely on both and to collect data from both the people closest to that person, but I don't think you can negate the opinion of the person themselves.
Was that done? Was there any by proxy?
No. And I mean, certainly when a person is in the depths of their illness and has no insight at all, of course a family member's opinion would probably be the most legitimate one to follow, right? Given that they're in you don't want everyone to take away autonomy, but when someone needs care and they're incapable of, you know, caring for themselves at that point, or even understanding that they need it, I think that maybe there is value. There is certainly value in respecting the family's perception of the quality of life.
Thank you.
Darlene has a question.
One question. I think you probably excluded this group, but as the relapse occurs, usually self-medication and substance abuse increases remarkably. And I wondered if any of the studies attempted to deal with that, because it could actually be a measure of a change.
I think in general, unfortunately, the issue of relapse was grossly underreported by a study. So I think, I'm not positive, but I don't think that those two studies did look at that. And again, it goes back to this is an incredibly important issue and it needs to be addressed further, but I don't think that the studies address that point, unfortunately.
To what extent is substance abuse involved in the etiology of schizophrenia?
Certainly, substance abuse such as stimulant abuse can contribute to stimulant-induced psychoses that are very characteristic of a schizophrenia psychosis. But that sort of psychosis is typically subsides when the substance abuse ends. But there has been studies reported that there can be long-term changes to the brain that the brain cannot go back to normal, and that there's a constant high level of because stimulant abuse increases dopamine firing in the brain, and the dopamine is what causes psychosis. It's a dopamine hypothesis that increased levels of dopamine perpetuate the psychotic symptoms. And so that's what a stimulant does, and it's thought that maybe there's brain changes that occur and that people result in having a perpetual problem thereafter. So.
Thank you very much.